The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we bring you two extremely interesting guests to guide us through the science of semen. Evolutionary biologist John Logsdon returns to the show to explain sexual selection and its effects on the evolutionary design of sperm cells. Then researcher and blogger Cy Curious joins us to discuss everything else you ever wanted to know about semen. We'll be explaining this particular bodily fluid in some detail, so if you've got small children listening, you might want to have them skip this episode. Thanks for listening, and enjoy The Science of Semen.
I'm speaking with John Logsdon, biologist, evolutionary biologist, and molecular evolutionary biologist, in that order. He's also an associate professor at the University of Iowa in the Department of Biological Sciences. I have John on the show as frequently as I can because he always has fascinating information on sex and evolution, which happen to be two of my favorite topics. Welcome back, sir.
Thanks for having me. Love being here.
So today we're talking about mating behavior and the evolution of sperm design.
Yeah. What else?
What else would we talk about? So what are we talking about exactly when we say sperm design?
The lead sentence on this paper says, sperm are the most diverse of all animal cell types. Sperm are all over the place with regard to, you know, how the cells look, how they work, how they function. And it turns out the reason why is because they're involved in a battle with the female genital tract, usually, and a battle with themselves to win their way to the egg.
So it's odd, but I've realized it's not really something that people generally think of there being more than one of sperm design. And I didn't realize that. So maybe you could tell everybody, how many kinds of sperm design are there really, roughly?
I have no idea. But they're quite diverse. They vary in length, size, morphology, almost anything you can think of. And so this statement of being the most diverse of animal cell types is backed up by a considerable amount of information.
Well, maybe give me some examples of different designs. Like, how would the designs differ?
There are big sperm, there are small sperm, there are motile sperm with tails on them, like we have. Actually, me, not you. Anyway, there are ones that actually don't have flagellar tails. They're amoeboid-like that move in different ways. There are ones that have barbs on them to stick in the side of presumably the female genital tract so that they don't get scooped out. So they're all kinds of different forms and sort of functions of sperm. The main function of the sperm, of course, is to provide the half of the dad's genetic material to move on to the next generation.
So what is the purpose of these design differences? What's the effect?
For internally fertilized organisms, there's an exchange of interests that go on between the male and the female. In an evolutionary sense, if the female could controlled, you know, would want the best sperm to fertilize her eggs. And so there are ways in which the female can actually control to some extent. So there's a lot of thought about females controlling who the fathers are, what we call pre-copulatory sexual selection. So, you know, choosing the flashy males, choosing the tougher males, choosing various aspects of the sort of standard sexual selection. But it turns out that there's also what we call post-copulatory sexual selection that goes on inside the genital tract. So, for example, females that can mate with different males might be able to control which one of them actually sires more of her offspring. And there's a whole bunch of mechanisms by which this can happen. Reading from a paper from Bill Eberhard, who's the master of this, there's a list of 24 here, but I'll just read a couple of them. Female-controlled processes that occur in different species that are known to increase the chances that a given male will sire her offspring. Okay, number one. Permit penetration deep enough to allow sperm deposition at the optimum site for storage or fertilization. So in other words, she'll let some boys penetrate not so, and other boys penetrate more, and the boys that penetrate more might get more children.
This is conscious?
Well, conscious, maybe not conscious, but there would be selection acting on that behavior. So these are just potential ways in which a female could control the paternity in a situation whereby, you know, multiple males are mating with her. I'm just going to randomly choose and discard sperm from previous males. So in other words, a female will mate with one male and she'll somehow eliminate that sperm from that male, you know, when presented with another male. Being presented from another male. Maybe she doesn't like him. That again, that's anthropomorphizing, but the point is that the female doesn't just control who she has sex with, she can control which one is going to be the father to her children, even though she might have already had sex with him. So the female has a lot of control, even after the sex act, for her own fertilization in many organisms. I'm going to pick one more randomly here. Refrain from aborting zygotes from current sperm or abort previously formed zygotes. So in other words, if a better male comes along, if she has some way of determining that, she can just abort the zygotes from the previous guy and start over. So you think about
choices.
It.
Choices.
Yeah. So the female has a lot of control, potentially. Not in all species, but different species might have different amounts of control. Okay. So that's the female side. The female is being choosy. And we often think about sexual selection as the female being choosy, right? The female is choosing the sexy male, the peacock with the big tail, all that kind of stuff, right? That's pre-copulatory. It turns out there's also this post-copulatory thing. So, you know, what's the counter to that? Well, the males are going to figure out, as much as possible, going to evolve ways around those things, right? So they're going to evolve sperm that are faster, sperm that are going to beat up on the other guy's sperm, sperm that can cooperate together. Certain organisms can produce sperm that some of which are actually not functional sperm. They're called pseudosperm or parasperm, maybe they're called, that can sort of gang up on maybe previous sperm and get rid of them. And favor the guy's own sperm, right? So there's lots of ways that the male is having this battle also. So the female has these defenses where she's sort of evolving response to, you know, paternity, but every male wants to actually have every sex act of his sort of generate offspring as well. So there's this battle really of the sexes inside the genital tract of females.
Wait, I have to ask. So which species is it exactly where
the species that we're talking – right. So the species, okay. Lots of species. Any species where there's multiple matings. So a species where there's monogamy, these things don't happen.
Interesting.
Or they happen a lot less because it's unclear actually whether there are species that are actually true monogamous anyway. But for those that are high on the monogamy scale, let's say, it turns out that there's not a huge amount of reason to actually have this battle of the sexes because – paternity is essentially assured. So the classic example are the bonobos. And you know what the main feature of bonobos is, right?
We're talking about their clitorises, right?
No, we're talking about the boys in this regard. But the girls probably have some interesting stuff,
I'm
too.
Sorry. When you say bonobo, all I can think is long pink clitoris that can grip iron bars.
But I think actually the other kind of chimpanzees actually have genitalia that are out there as well.
Good to know.
So the main thing about bonobos is that the boys have big balls. And the reason why they have big balls is because they're very, very promiscuous. The tie-in there is that they're creating lots of sperm, and so there's lots and lots of sperm competition. If you're a male and you want to assure paternity and you're mating with the same female that some other guy mated with an hour ago, one way to actually have a better shot at fertilizing her eggs is to just put more in there. And so they have large testicles. And it turns out that testicle size is a pretty good indicator of polygamy in organisms,
right?
From a male perspective, as it turns out. And that would make some sense. So that's an idea of one of the things that goes on, just make a lot more. Or sperm could be evolved themselves in a way that move faster, kill off the other guy's sperm, you know, all other kind of things that you can imagine. So there's a lot of potential evolution for sperm to sort of, you know, be the best at getting there to the egg and fertilizing.
Okay, so the sperm that fight off the other sperm? I didn't realize this was a thing. What species is that in?
So I think this is fairly common that there's this recent case in mice where certain sperm of one individual would cooperate with each other and, you know, sort of work against the sperm of another potential sire.
It's like a team building exercise.
Exactly, right. You know,
brilliant.
So you know, one of the brothers make it, you know.
So I was speaking with Cambridge geneticist Josh Witten about this topic. And he asked, what's the evidence that sperm differences are due to selection for multiple mating competition rather than neutral evolution?
Neutral evolution is, in this particular context, the best way I describe neutral evolution is shit happens. If there's not something wrong with some feature. You know, as long as it's not being selected against, it's going to happen, right? So, you know, sort of in the absence of selection, what happens?
Right.
And so that's one sort of idea of neutral evolution. So in other words, so I think what he's asking is, in the absence of selection for a function, that, you know, they can basically be of any shape as long as they work. And it is possible to think about that as a possibility. But this paper that I want to talk to you about, which is The Mating Behavior in Evolution of Sperm Design by Scharrer et al., they're working on flatworms, hermaphroditic flatworms. Each individual is both a boy and a girl at the same time. And they actually have evidence against this idea. So these are organisms that are simultaneous hermaphrodites. In other words, when they're mating, they're being both a boy and a girl, and their mate is also being both a boy and a girl. And it turns out that most of these organisms are like that. You know, they're both playing the male role and the female role. One interesting thing is when they get done mating, they separate, and the organism, the individual, actually takes their mouth to their female genital opening and literally sucks the sperm out. So in other words, that is consistent with the idea that it's advantageous to be more the male than the female. So if you're trying to put more energy into being a male, you're going to then create sperm that they could resist this sort of behavior, which is the sucking of the sperm. And it turns out that the sperm actually have all kinds of hooks and barbs, and they embed in the sort of female part, presumably to avoid being sucked out. So how do you sort of test this idea? Well, they've got this great case where it turns out that some of these species, instead of being simultaneous hermaphrodites, their male part turns into essentially a needle. And instead of inseminating into the sort of female opening, they actually inject it underneath the epidermis. So those sperm now are not subjected to the same kind of selective constraints of having to attach inside the female opening in order to retain. You know, so the females don't suck those out. They can't get rid of them. They're inside their bodies. So how that happened, we don't know, but it did happen at least twice based on their analyses. But what's really interesting is that when that happens, the sperm clearly evolve in a way that reduces all these appendages and all these extra features that were thought to be maybe ways of sort of keeping them from getting sucked out. And so they basically evolved to be simpler. And when they're simpler, they presumably can swim faster. They can make it to, you know, to fertilize the egg faster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is that they showed at least twice in evolution that the loss of the sort of complicated simultaneous thing and all of the barbs and the shoots and barbs. What's the saying?
With slings and arrows of a
the slings and arrows. The slings and arrows of sperm. They've
That's
them down.
Beautiful.
So that's what happened. So that's the story, is that there's this idea that the sperm in the simultaneous hermaphrodites are actually evolving, that have evolved those features in order to not be sucked out. But when you lose the sucking, they reduce down to simpler states. So that suggests that the barbs themselves actually have some function that has to do with this simultaneous business.
Josh, there's your evidence, sir. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm talking about the evolution of sperm with evolutionary biologist John Logsdon. And we'll be right back with more after this brief message.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And I'm talking about mating behavior and sperm design with evolutionary biologist John Logsdon. So you found something over the break.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit more about the idea that different individuals, males, can sort of kill off the sperm of other males. And that does occur in mammals. So I found that out by reading. But then I read the next sentence that shows douche-like flushing out of stored sperm from the female with a jet of water in sharks, apparently. But see reference 19 for rejection of the douche hypothesis.
That's a t-shirt right there.
So For what it's worth, the douche hypothesis has not been fully tested.
Oh, so many things I could say. I, sir, have tested the douche hypothesis. Yes. All right. All right. So what kind of sperm design would be considered the best one? And maybe best really isn't the right word. Most effective? Or is it just situational?
As with most of biology, it's going to depend on the consequences of the interaction between the individuals and all the other, and, you know, sort of, you know, one aspect that we already talked about is whether females mate mostly with one male or with multiple males. Issues like, you know, whether they're provided other resources. So, you know, some females are presented with what we call nuptial gifts, including spermatheca that are eaten, that males provide them. You know, so I don't suspect there is actually an optimal sperm design. It depends on the specifics of the organism. So for internal fertilization, which is mostly what we're talking about here, for external fertilization, there's not much variation, which makes sense, right? You know, so the idea would be that for external fertilization, you want to make a lot, ones that swim, that can find the eggs, stuff like that. For internal fertilization, it's going to depend on the arms race, the specific arms race that goes on between the male and the female. And it's sort of like, what's the optimal color strategy for a bird? Well, there isn't one, but being colorful might be generally useful for birds in terms of sexual selection.
Right. So, well, let's talk about human sperm then. So what are the advantages to the way your sperm operates?
That's a very personal question, but I might try to answer it anyway.
Thank you.
As I recall, in terms of where we sit on the sort of testicle size distribution among primates relative to our body sizes, that we're somewhere in the middle, which suggests that we, ancestrally in any case, as a species, are not particularly monogamous.
Right.
So that would suggest that for humans, males produce a huge amount of sperm per ejaculate, many, 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 many more than are necessary. And probably part of that is that we're evolutionarily constrained. Our ancestors were competing sperm, one guy to the next, right? As I recall, again, I'm not a deep expert on primate issues, but gorillas, I think, have the tiniest balls of of the primates relative to their body size, and,
right.
And it's largely because they have harems, right? So the silverbacks basically control a group of females, and they're pretty much the only ones that are getting it. The non-silverback males, they're you know, they might be horny, but they're probably not getting it very often, as revealed in their testicle size, probably.
It just has
to do with the social structure, you know, but they might become silverback males one day.
Is there a worst design that you can think of? And regardless of the situational aspect, is there a design that practically guarantees that a species will be rare or maybe will eventually die out?
I think that wouldn't happen. I mean, there might be some consequences, you know, these evolutionary dead ends that, you know, sort of take in a certain direction. But I'm not aware of that. I mean, if that's the case, that species might die out. But I'm not aware of a case that sort of went down the dead end. Now, what's interesting is this case that we talked about. And these are actually quite closely related species. These are different species within the same genus of flatworms. Now, I don't know how that compares to, you know, how distantly related these species are of flatworms to, say, humans and chimps. I don't know. They didn't provide divergence times. But one of the interesting things is that within closely related species, this has happened at least twice. So it suggests that these evolutionary events can fairly easily evolve and quickly. There's actually a case that they talk about in the paper that they actually don't spend much time on, which I thought was one of the most interesting things, was a case of Macrostomum finlandense. And they haven't caught them in the act of doing it. So they don't really have any idea about what their sex lives are. But they do know what their penises look like, and they do know what their sperm look like. And it turns out their penises look pretty much like those traumatic inseminators, the one with the needle. And their closest relatives are ones that aren't the needle, right? And their sperm are somewhere in between, if you will, the complicated one with the barbs on it to hang onto the inside of the vaginal tract. Vaginal, that's not the word in these organisms, but the female tract.
The receptive tract. Okay.
So they don't get sucked out. So they aren't simple like the ones that get injected, but they're not as complicated as the ones that, you know, get stuck in the tract, suggesting that maybe even another time it's evolved. So I think that's really interesting that you can actually, in a relatively short period of time, evolve pretty intense differences. And this is actually consistent with sexual selection in general, is that it's very, very powerful because it's selection on the sexual parts itself, whereas selection acts through sexual reproduction and reproduction in general to give rise to features. But sexual selection is really powerful because it's actually acting on the sex lives, which is the sort of force that moves things forward anyway.
Right.
So things can evolve very quickly under sexual selection. It's a very powerful mechanism.
So sperm evolution relates to the male or not, you know, the giver. You know what I mean.
Yeah, the male.
Okay, thank you.
We can just call it boys.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So that relates to the boy's genitalia. So how does this relate to the female genitalia?
Again, it's this arms race. So we spent the first part of our talk talking about the male side, but it turns out there's a reciprocal thing going on the female side. And it turns out that female internal organs are actually really complicated too. And lots of organisms will have these sort of dead-end passages and all other kind of stuff, places to store sperm. And so the females are also evolving on to control their reproduction themselves to some extent. You might remember the duck penises.
Do remind us of the duck penises.
A very famous, now infamous, Science Online 2010 story about Carl Zimmer talking about duck penises. And it turns out that some ducks, they actually don't have penises. They're actually intermittent organs. But they're kind of penis-like. They're sort of delivery kind of vehicles. They're kind of like shovels. But it turns out that there's coevolution between the complex female parts and the male parts. And it turns out that there's this corkscrew shape of the male penis. And it turns out on the female side, they fit just right. You know, so how do you get, you know, a corkscrew to fit a corkscrew? Well, they've co-evolved for a long period of time. And so, you know, the females are trying to control it. The males are trying to figure out the path. And it turns out to be a pretty interesting story, sort of battle of the sexes on the inside.
So would something like that affect sperm design then?
In this case, it's correlated, right? So if – okay, so it turns out that penises are male delivery vehicles, shall we say, male parts – are also quite elaborate in organisms that have many male mates. The idea is that if you're a male and you're mating with the female and there was another guy that was there deposited his sperm, one thing you might want to do is scoop it out or somehow disable it. And so it turns out male penises are actually quite interesting as well, involved in the sort of post-copulatory stuff. You can think of mostly as getting rid of the other guy's sperm, but there are other ways to control it. But that would be correlated then with sperm that are better swimmers, that are faster swimmers, and that, you know, that would have different design features that would, you know, win in this sort of battle of the – it's sort of like – imagine, you know, the sort of male-male antlers, you know, that's going on except for inside the female. And that's essentially what's going on.
John, do you plan on writing a book anytime soon? Because I would read the crap out of that.
I've been thinking about it for about a year now.
Please, people, send this man emails about writing a book.
As you know, so you're being kind. I started working on a book at National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, where I was a sabbatical scholar, and I got going on it, and I have a book proposal, and I have been trying to get back to writing it in my spare time, and I'm always inspired by talking to people like you and talking about the things that are really interesting to me, which are usually about sex.
I may have to start a petition. John, thank you so much for being here again.
Thanks, Desiree.
And you can find evolutionary biologist John Logsdon at johnlogsdon.com. He doesn't update frequently enough, but you can head there. You can also head to the link we've included at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Cy Curious to talk more about dirty science after this.
Hi, Cy.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today, my guest is Cy Curious, and we're talking about semen. Welcome to the show, Cy.
Hi. It's great to be here.
So you're an interesting case. You have tons of credibility in the science blogging community, but you use a pseudonym. So why's that?
There are a couple of reasons. I rather like using a pseudonym because it's really allowed me to build my own reputation from scratch. And many people will say, well, you know, the reputation of your name is more important. And that's as may be, but Cy Curious now has her own reputation. And it's a very separate thing. But I am actually a pseudonym because I am an animal researcher. and I get death threats and other unfortunate things. So to prevent my work and the work of my colleagues from being impacted by my voice in the blogosphere, I maintain a pseudonym.
But you do have a PhD in physiology, a Bachelor of Arts in philosophy, and a Bachelor of Science in biology. So you do have some actual qualifications to back up the semen that we will be talking about tonight.
Sadly, I wish I had a pure PhD in semen physiology. At this point, I've read most of the relevant lit.
Are there disadvantages, though, to writing under a pseudonym?
Absolutely. People do not trust suits, and I miss out on a lot of opportunities because of it. A lot of more professional writing gigs, people would really prefer to have someone who writes under their own name. And of course, the instant I criticize anything, I get the comment of I'm a coward hiding behind a pseudonym and that I would never say that under my real name, when the reality is I'd probably be meaner.
Well, I love your blog, especially the Friday Weird Science posts, which are fantastic. So maybe can you explain to our audience what those are about?
It started mostly as something anything I find really funny. And sex is really funny. I mean, the only reason people take sex seriously is because we're used to it. I'm sure if, like, aliens saw people having sex, they'd be laughing their asses off. So that's something I find funny. But it's other things like prairie voles and frogs that can sprout bones from their hands. Anything I find really funny and weird that I want to blog about.
And that was one of the problems, because I've wanted to have you on the show for quite a while now, but I couldn't narrow it down enough to choose a topic. So then I spoke to the lovely John Logsdon, who wanted to do a show on sperm design. And yes. I realized that you, yourself, have a great many posts on sperm-related topics. And so it all came together.
Yeah, no, I'm thrilled that I'll be kind of coming back to back with John. I think he's an excellent researcher.
And a fantastic interview as well.
Oh, I'm sure.
So the title of the first study that I want to talk about is Swinging High and Low. Why do the testes hang at different levels? A theory on surface area and thermoregulation. And I love that title.
I always think of it like, you know the song, do your ears hang low? Do they wobble to and fro? So I think of it like, do your balls hang low? Do they wobble to and fro? Can you tie them in a knot?
So why do the testicles hang at all, much less at different levels?
Well, the testicles hang low because sperm needs to be kept at a temperature that is slightly lower than body temperature. I think about 2 degrees Celsius lower than body temperature. And because of this, this means you need to have them outside of the body cavity or your sperm are going to be too hot. But of course, if they're hanging, the testicles are hanging like too low, they'll get too cold. And so the really cool thing about balls is that balls respond to temperature really, really dramatically. So when they get cold, I'm sure everyone has heard of shrinkage. Balls can actually recede almost entirely up into the body cavity. It really makes me wonder about like scientists in Antarctica and like whether or not their balls ever like descend. And of course, when you're hot, they can actually hang really low. It can get pretty extreme.
Well, that's proof right there. I think that we weren't intelligently designed because they would be in armor or something, right? Or like an exoskeleton.
Yes and no. I mean, rat balls, for example, are extremely large. I don't know if you've ever seen a rat's balls, but they're huge. They actually drag the floor when the rat walks, which you'd think would be really unpleasant, but the rats don't mind. I think that human testicles might be more sensitive to things like pain than other mammals.
Well, you actually provided stats on the percentage of lower lefties versus lower righties. Do you remember what those were? Because I have the stats here if you don't.
Oh, okay. 20% right. That's like 25% equal. And then like I don't actually have the hard number on that, but apparently 10% of men only have one testicle.
Which is really interesting. You would think that would be lower.
And not necessarily, because they do have two testicles. It's just that only one descends from the body cavity, which can be regulated by hormonal things. It can be regulated by physical things. It does not decrease fertility, as far as I can tell.
Well, if for anybody that actually wants the numbers, it's 42% of you who have the left testicle hanging lower, if you wanted a club or something.
I wonder, though, it's probably like lower for right testicle. It's like 20% for right testicle.
21.
So it's lower with the right testicle, so you'd think, like, you know, they'd form a club because it's more exclusive, you know?
Oh, that's true. A support group, perhaps. So there could be lots of different reasons why testicles hang at different heights. You listed differences in embryonic development or vascular differences or evolutionary differences, but this study proposes temperature.
Yes, and I actually don't think they're wrong. It's medical hypotheses, and the Journal of Medical Hypotheses is incredibly entertaining. because they actually don't want you to submit data. It's supposed to be hypotheses only, which I want to publish there someday. I think it'd be awesome.
I could see that.
But they actually think that if you have the two testicles hanging side by side, the interface is too hot. You've got too much surface area being covered by skin or other testicles. And the surface area needs to be less, so you have one ball hanging lower, so that you keep a more even temperature. I'd like to see that tested. I figure you take, you know, guys with relatively even hanging testicles and ones that have, like, really, really different hanging balls, right? And get them both to ejaculate in a cup and see how the sperm levels look. I think that would answer that question pretty quick.
You are brilliant. I think you should be in charge of research facilities everywhere. Well, regardless of being able to test that theory, you wrote that you think that maybe that's not necessarily the right answer anyway.
My personal hypothesis is space. Balls take up space. They take up a good bit of space, and men find it extremely uncomfortable to cross their legs at the thigh, a lot of them. You've seen guys on the subway, right, with their legs all spread out, like they got the Eiffel Tower in there. It's not so much for the penis, so much as for the balls, to give them lots of room and air. And
right.
Like, so my hypothesis is that one hangs lower than the other to actually allow for the legs to be closer together, which is more, I think it's actually more ergonomically efficient for, like, running and things like that.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. You've tuned into the Semen Science episode, and my guest today is researcher and blogger Cy Curious. So since we're talking about temperature, how about this study? Protection from scrotal hyperthermia in laptop computer users.
So basically, with the high usage among certain yuppie generations of laptops, like among bloggers, for example, laptops generate a lot of heat. And as I mentioned before, sperm need to be kept cool. So the scientists wanted to know if the laptop itself produced too much heat and in fact produced decreases in sperm function and low sperm counts due to laptop usage. So they did a study. They did bare laptops on closed legs, pads with a laptop on top of the pad on closed legs, and open legs spread out, you know, with a pad on. And they found that in all things, the left and the right scrotal temperature increased all the time sitting down. But in the regular laptop with the closed legs and the laptop pad with the closed legs, you got increases in scrotal temperature that were actually high enough, they hypothesized, to impact sperm function. I was kind of upset they didn't just take the whole, like, just sitting there, because sedentary activity, where you're just kind of sitting there, does actually increase the temperature of your balls.
You said that they also tested the 70-degree leg spread condition with the laptop pad, but not without it.
Yeah, that also was kind of weird to me. I think probably because of issues with balance.
And they also didn't assess fertility, which I assume you would want to.
You know, I imagine these researchers have a lot of trouble saying, okay, great, so now that you've played StarCraft II on this laptop with your legs closed, could you just go and jack off in that cup for me, please? You know, a lot of people might feel a little weird about volunteering for that study, so.
We have a question from the chat room.
Has anyone developed a good hypothesis or know the answer for why testicles are not better protected? And that's from Barbara Drescher.
I actually don't know. Do you have a hypothesis?
I'm wondering if it has something to do with temperature, because if it was better protected, wouldn't that raise the heat?
Well, it also is, yet again, proof we're not intelligently designed. Why can't sperm take it at 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, man?
So temperature is occasionally related to fertility.
Quite related, actually.
Well, our next study is contraceptive efficacy of polyester-induced azoospermia in normal men.
So this is one of my favorites.
Yeah, who, what now?
I think I titled that one A Tote for Your Scrote. I loved that one. I had so much fun coming up with, like, alternate names for that study.
There's a list for anyone who would like to check that out.
But yeah, they did the study in humans and in dogs, which I would kill to see the pictures of the dogs wearing little polyester underpants.
She also has pictures of many of these things on her website.
So they took these men, and the deal is they're looking for male contraceptives. Because right now, the only effective male contraceptive is the snip-snip of the vasectomy. And, you know, a lot of guys feel kind of weird about the permanence of that. And so a lot of the burden of contraceptive use is placed on women. And many people feel that men should be allowed to determine whether or not they spawn as well as women. So they haven't had any luck with hormonal contraceptives in men. And so they're looking for kind of external things other than condoms that might cause low sperm count, but that are reversible. And so they took these men and they put them in this little ball sling made of polyester, which is like, how uncomfortable can you be? And they had them wear it for a year, all the time.
Man, it's for science, but that's some commitment right there.
Yeah, and I mean, they didn't ask about their libidos, but I'd be far more interested to know about the libidos of their partners. Because if you see a picture of the dude in the sling, sexy is not a word that comes to mind.
And so they had to wear these while having sex as well, let's be clear.
Oh, yes. Whole year.
So what were the results of this study?
After the first 4 months, they had total lack of sperm in the ejaculate, completely gone. Luckily, it was reversible. So after a year, they took them off. They also saw, actually, the balls got smaller. They got increases in testicular temperatures. And they also, the azoospermia, which is the lack of sperm in the ejaculate, got so bad that the seminiferous tubules, which are part of the production system for sperm, started to actually degenerate. So it was pretty extreme. But after a year, they took it off. And I think within 5 months, sperm counts were back to normal.
So what's the mechanism behind this? What did the paper conclude?
Well, the paper thought it was electrostatic potentials, and that the polyester uniquely was creating these electrostatic potentials that were transmitting into the testicles and disrupting the electrostatic potentials of your sperm and causing this lack of sperm formation. I don't know about that, because that involves some pretty major electrostatic potentials. You have tons of electrostatic potentials, you know, in your cell membranes. I mean, there's lots there. And so I question whether or not the electrostatic potential would actually make it across the skin barrier.
And the paper really didn't test that, per se.
No, right. Though other studies, I think the dogs did actually test the electrostatic potential and found there was a potential. But I don't know that it was strong enough, honestly.
Well, there's the dogs in pants, and then there's the rats in pants. There's a lot of pants. So tell us about that study. And I'm warning all of the listeners who are maybe a bit specific, this is not exactly semen. It's more about libido than semen. But eventually, if you follow the libido trail, it becomes semen related, I would say. So I would give this a pass.
It's close enough. And thanks. It's rats in pants. You don't need a reason.
Actually, that's a very good point. Do continue.
I recommend everybody go look at the picture because it's so cute. Oh,
we will have links to all of these posts, by the way.
So I admire this guy because it was a single author paper. So clearly he did everything himself. And he had 75 rats. And the 75 rats all wore pants for a year, which is a lot of pants. I have to assume he changed the pants because otherwise you're going to have some really disgusting pants. I mean, I don't care how many holes you have for the penis and for the anus. It's going to be some nasty pants, all right? So I have to imagine he changed a lot of little rat diapers for a while. But he had them wear for a year. And after a year, he had all of the rats wearing 5 different conditions. So there was the condition that was going commando. There was the condition that wore polyester, like in the men's study. The condition that wore cotton polyester blend. The guys that wore cotton and a group of long-suffering rats wearing wool.
Oh, that's just not fair.
For a year. Oh, you could just imagine little looks of suffering on the little rat faces. But yeah, after at 6 months and a year, he put them with some hot ladies, and he watched them have sex, and checked to see how the sexual behavior of the rats was impacted by the underpants that they were wearing. So it turns out that the animals wearing the polyester and the cotton polyester blends, they mounted more. So it's like they're trying to get up on the girl more than the other guys.
Right.
But they had fewer intromissions, which means they came less. And they actually managed to have sex less. So he says that this is a low libido condition induced by the pants. I don't know. It could just be that polyester is really uncomfortable.
Or embarrassing, really, because they're wearing polyester pants for a year.
They are wearing polyester pants. And maybe the rats looked down and realized they were wearing paisley and just couldn't do it. He did not test for sperm counts, unfortunately. And I really wish he had. And what I really wish they'd all done, all these groups, is looked at testosterone. Because testosterone has a good bit more to do with libido than the question of like whether or not you have sperm or how many mounts and intromissions. I think looking at the testosterone and how that correlated would have really said what the pants were maybe doing to the rats.
When people ask me why I like science so much, I think I'm just going to send them a link to this episode. Because really, like, how can you not? So on Facebook today, I was speaking with Derek Colanduno of the Skepticality podcast about how male and female sperm have different magnetic properties, and I thought that sounded like bunk. but he said that they use magnetic separation in livestock breeding, and they do it all the time. So you say yes. So there is truth to this?
Not really. Well, okay. Sort of. As far as I know, I don't think that male and female sperm actually have different magnetic properties, but they do use magnetics to separate male and female sperm. And they do it kind of the way people run techniques like flow cytometry and protein separation techniques like ELISA's. They use antibodies. So basically, male sperm are distinguished from female sperm by having a Y antigen on the outside of their little spermy coat. And you can use an antibody on that antigen. Then you can link that antibody that's been bound to the antigen on the outside of the little Y sperm to another antigen, which is on a magnetized bead. Then you run the whole thing by the magnet. And all those little links are going to hold, and the magnet will take only the ones that are linked this way, which means it will take only the Y sperm. And that allows you to separate out the male and the female sperm. And apparently it works like for 98%. You get like a 98% female sperm concentration.
And see, this is another thing that I didn't realize. Male and female sperm.
Well, they're not actually male and female.
Right.
But I'm sure you know about meiosis, right?
Right.
So gametes are created by meiosis, where each regular cell has two copies of all the chromosomes. And if you're a boy, you have, instead of two X's, you have XY. And if you're a girl, you have XX. Well, when the cells go through meiosis and become gametes, gametes only have half of the chromosomes of a regular cell. Because when they mix half their chromosomes with the lady's egg, which is half of their chromosomes, you get double chromosomes, and that is a full cell. So that means that when you go through meiosis and you have half the chromosomes, half of them will be X and half of them will be Y.
But it's like that thing, you don't think about sperm being female. It's like cats are girls, dogs are boys, and that's just how they are.
Well, they're not female. They have their X
right.
sperm as opposed to Y sperm. And so that's actually a question I used to ask on tests. You know, which parent determines the sex of the baby? And the answer is the male. So all those times when, like, male kings throughout history blamed their queens for not being able to conceive sons, you're jerks. That's not true.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about semen. My guest is Cy Curious of the Scientopia blog network, and we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're thinking about science as an instrument and the parallels between an understanding of music and the history of science. Thomas Levinson, author of Newton and the Counterfeiter, returns to talk about his book Measure for Measure, A Musical History of Science. And we're joined by Professor Vaughn Macefield to talk about his project that translates neural impulses into audible sound. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today my guest is Cy Curious. Cy has a PhD in physiology, a Bachelor of Arts in philosophy, a Bachelor of Science in biology, and she's also the author of Neurotic Physiology on the Scientopia blog network. And we've been talking about semen. So occasionally, for a variety of reasons, you want to prevent the semen from going anywhere, which often means, you like that segue? This is my condom segue. So, Cy, you took a look at a study titled, Male Condoms That Break in Use Do So Mostly by a Blunt Puncture Mechanism. So,
because, you know, a sharp puncture mechanism would mean you had a very odd-shaped penis. I mean, you know, think about it.
Right, good. Thank you. So any kind of condom failure, though, is relatively rare, correct?
It's difficult to say. I actually conducted a really informal survey where I basically just put a survey out on the internet and said, hey, guys, how often do your condoms break? And about 50% of people had never had a break. But you're supposed to, if your condom breaks, you're supposed to send it back to the company to help them build a better condom. But, I mean, how many people, when their condom breaks, are going to package that thing up and send it back to the company? You know what I mean?
I think they're busy freaking out, really.
Many are busy freaking out. Many do not want to package things that are covered in their bodily fluids. And I can understand that. So you're always going to have some bias in these studies because of that. But they actually wanted to evaluate how the condoms broke and why the condoms were breaking. And the cool thing was, to do this, they built a machine. And the machine has this huge dildo on it and like a fleshlight on the other end.
Also, again, she has pictures.
I was in graduate school when I first saw this article, and I remember running into my laboratory going, "You guys, you will never believe this." And I had to pass it around the entire department. Everyone thought it was awesome.
Oh, it also has an awesome name.
Yeah, the Simple Mechanical Coital Model.
That's formal.
But it's got a piston, and it drives with a certain amount of force that one must assume to be representative of regular coitus. It drives the dildo into the fleshlight repetitively, obviously. And they used this to test various condoms and to test condom breaks. They did describe it as physiologically accurate, but they didn't actually give their measurements. It looks okay. It's tough to say. But they also took a bunch of condoms that they got back from the companies. And they received a bunch that were actually broken. They had a bunch that had another defect. They don't say what that defect was. I don't know why you'd send back a condom if it was not broken. And another whole bunch were actually not defective. And they looked at where the condoms were broken. And they assessed why the condoms might be broken there. And the biggest condom breakage were things at the tip, which, I mean, pretty obvious why that might occur there, right? So 97% broke during intercourse, probably because if the condom breaks while you're putting it on, you're far too embarrassed to send it back in. They also did repeated stretching of condoms over the condom demonstrator, which is used in condom factories. It's like this big glass dildo that you stretch your condoms over to test how good they are. And they looked at how many stretchings it took to actually cause breakage. Obviously, condoms are a careful balance. You know, you got to have like good enough latex to make sure there's nothing getting through there, but you also got to have thin enough latex that people will not, you know, hate wearing them.
Right.
So the problem is, when you are walking this really thin line, and if you get any thinner, you're going to break more often, but you get any thicker, So they had several types of breaks. The biggest ones were my favorite name, the ones broken near the tip called eruption punctures. and those are apparently caused by what they call blunt puncture.
Hence the title.
Yes.
Now this is the thing. This went from you discussing this on your blog to, well, as generally occurs on the internet, there were a bunch of commenters on that post who wanted to share their own condom breakage experiments.
Yes.
So how did you go from a couple of comments to deciding to design a proper survey about condom breakage?
Well, people started commenting with things like, "Oh my God, well, when I broke my condom, it peeled that back like a banana," to which I say, you didn't stop soon enough. So you had a whole bunch of people who were relatively comfortable airing their condom breakage stories on the internet. And then I was like, well, okay, so how many people has this actually happened to? What happened? You know, I want to know. And then Bora Zivkovic of Blog Around the Clock pointed out that a lot of people probably would feel kind of weird just up and telling people their condom breakage stories. So I designed a survey, and it's an anonymous survey, and I had about 200 respondents.
So your research was actually really interesting to me, more interesting than the original study, personally. So let's look at your results for a moment. So what kind of activity were people participating in when the condom broke?
Well, I had to choose specific things. And so some people gave me other, but I also included oral, anal high athleticism versus anal low athleticism, and vaginal high athleticism versus vaginal low athleticism. There are, of course, other options, but I just picked what I thought would be the most common.
Right.
So the highest number of breaks were during vaginal high athleticism, which I don't know whether that's people using a swing or people just, you know, shaking the bed really hard.
Right.
The second highest were vaginal low athleticism. And you'd actually expect both of those because that's the most common type of intercourse. So, of course, you're going to have the most breakages there.
Well, you also asked about the general level of lubrication present, both inside and outside the condom.
Yeah, I wish I'd asked this question better, because obviously you're going to have the greatest respondents for relatively high outside and relatively low inside, because the vast majority of sexual encounters are going to be that way. So I wish there was another way to ask this question, and I'm not really sure how to go about it. But it was pretty evenly divided. About 50% said it was high lubrication outside and low inside, which is presumably what you'd call ideal conditions. A good percentage was high outside and high inside, which presumably involved penile lubrication prior to the application of the condom. Low outside versus high inside, and low outside versus low inside, which I thought might cause a higher number of breaks due to, you know, excess friction. But that's a hard correlation to draw, so.
I was actually thinking about it when I was rereading this post before the interview. Now, I would say that there's a sort of a higher ratio of other scientists that read each other's science blogs. So do you think that that has any effect? I'm just wondering.
I don't know. I don't want to, like, offend people.
We can move on. We can move on. I just yeah. Maybe I want the audience to think about that for a moment.
No comments.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about the science of semen. My guest is Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher and fantastically pseudonymed science blogger. So if for some reason you can't avoid the semen, there may be some benefits.
That was pretty brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you. So the next study I want to talk to you about is, does semen have antidepressant properties? And that's a fairly clear title, but yeah. I don't want to give away the answer yet. Let's break down how they tested that, first of all.
Well, so they gave a whole bunch of college women, so they took college girls. Most people who do human studies in the United States use college students, right?
Right.
Because, you know, they're there. They're on campus. It's not hard to get to.
And they need
but
money.
But the bad thing is, this means your data is very skewed.
Right.
So in this case, the data is skewed, but there you go. They took a whole bunch of college women. They asked them about the frequency of sexual intercourse, whether they used condoms, how long it had been since they last had sex, and they gave them the Beck Depression Inventory to look at whether or not they were depressed. And what they found was that women who went bareback showed lower depression scores than women who either used condoms or were not sexually active. And they found that time since last episode of sexual intercourse tended to correlate with mood in women. Shocking.
I was going to say, but what they propose as the mechanism here is interesting.
Yeah, they think that the hormones in semen that are absorbed through the vaginal tract probably antagonize depressive symptoms and have antidepressant properties, yes.
And why would that be? That the tissue inside the vagina is porous?
The tissue inside the vagina is very, very absorbent. So you can take in a lot of stuff that way. So it's certainly possible to have hormonal transmission that way. I mean, Lord knows the semen has a lot of hormones. So it's certainly possible.
But let's also talk about alternate hypothesis. The maybe people are just happier when they're having sex bit.
I think there's certainly that. First of all, they didn't control for things like oral contraceptives. You're going to tell me that the hormones from the semen in your reproductive tract are going to outweigh, say, the hormones that you're taking every day in a pill? Give me a break. Secondly, the sexually active women are assumed to have semen in the reproductive tract after sex. And there's a lot of caveats to that. You know, a lot of times sexually active women not using condoms are going to have other methods of contraception. That
right.
includes things like the pull and pray. I'm sure
I haven't
that
heard
one.
That term.
Oh, yeah.
but consider that stolen. Okay.
And of course, they also stated that women who didn't use the condoms might be more likely to be in a committed relationship. You might have happiness related to that. Women who are not having sex might be not having sex because they are depressed. So there's lots of caveats here, really. I will believe it once you give me semen in a vaginal suppository, test it in like 200 women, and then you can tell me.
Now, we have some audience questions piling up here.
I've read about drugs that can be given to men which inhibit spermatogenesis. So how come we have no male pill? That's from Bytor.
There are some hormones that I've heard of that can inhibit spermatogenesis. The main reason, I think, is that, for example, female contraceptives are designed around cyclic variations in hormones in women. So women have a hormonal regulation that varies on a roughly monthly cycle. So you can actually stabilize that by giving various levels of exogenous hormones, and you're going to have a more stable level and you won't ovulate. And that's oral contraceptive for you. Men do not vary on a monthly cycle. In fact, they vary, I think, daily and in fact, almost hourly. And all of the variations in male hormones during the day do not affect spermatogenesis. And so that makes it very difficult to create a contraceptive that is hormonal in men that will actually inhibit spermatogenesis. You'd probably have to give some pretty crazy doses that would have some pretty nasty side effects.
All right, there's really no way for me to smoothly segue into this next study, and I tried so hard. But I really do want to talk about it. The title is Studies on Vaginal Malodor Humans. So what's this one about, Cy?
I talked about smelling fishy, which I'm sure is something people have heard. It's about oral contraceptive sponges. these were really popular in like the 70s, I think. Basically, it was an effective form of birth control that was kind of like a cervical cap, except in this case it was a sponge that is covered in spermicide and inserted up against your cervix. And it apparently worked pretty well. I think it was like 91% effective. But the women who were using it noted that it smelled really bad and that they would start to get this really bad vaginal malodor wearing the sponges. And the whole question was, well, what's causing the smell? So they took a whole bunch of women who were either having sex or not having sex and put in these sponges. And apparently the real problem was that the women were putting in these contraceptive sponges and not washing them. So, yeah. You know, hygiene was a lot worse before the 70s. They were improving rapidly.
So, but this is the thing. So it's, yes, the hygienic part is part of it, but really, what is the bit that smelled?
So they found that the smell was coming only from the women who had had sex. Women who had not had sex did not have any problems with vaginal malodor, which is proof that, by the way, the vagina does not naturally smell bad. And they found that the women who had sex, it was the sperm, it was actually the semen that had stayed in the sponge and had gotten broken down by the spermicide, actually like broke down and smelled really nasty.
So what have we learned here?
We've learned that should you suffer from vaginal malodor, blame the funky spunk.
We have another question from the chat room.
Is there any truth to the claim that citrus, especially pineapple juice, sweetens the flavor of semen? Any studies in peer-reviewed medical journals on this? That's from Ben Radford.
I've looked, and perhaps my PubMed foo is not good. I've been dying to do a study on that. But you gotta realize that that's a really subjective measure. I mean, what tastes good to one person doesn't taste good to another person. So, I mean, you could say that eating a diet very high in fructose might increase fructose amounts in your semen, which thus might make it sweeter, but that would have to be tested. So, no, I don't think the studies have been done. And of course, you know, you'd have to have like actual taste testers who'd be willing to go down the line and say, oh, this one tastes better, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10. And probably hard to find volunteers.
I was going to say, would an ethics board allow you to do that?
Probably not.
Okay, last question is from Liz Warren. Semen stains on fabric. How do I wash them out?
Am I curious or am I good housekeeping? I would say cold water and soap. If you're having problems, maybe like dish soap. The thing is, you know, are you talking straight up semen or are you talking semen and, say, spermicide or semen and, say, lubricant? Those are going to change like how it stains and how you're going to wash it out probably.
I was going to ask what her partner was eating.
I was going to say, if it stains, I wonder if it's coming out a different color.
This show has been very educational. Psycurious, you are welcome back anytime. You absolutely must check out her blog, especially on Fridays for Friday Weird Science at scientopia.org/blogs/psycurious. There is also a link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there, you might like to click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to archived episodes, subscribe to the show, or possibly write a glowing review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Schell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online, reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing.
shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.